others who were much younger, you know, they were looking for something.
Well, but you were looking for something too, weren't you?
Of course I was. We all were in those days. When I say we all, I mean, you know, people that were interested in doing something were looking for something. And we couldn't go to the civil rights movement, most of us. And it was also mostly over by the time we could have. So Cesar Chavez came along at just a particularly critical and crucial time in the 60s for people like myself, just to use me as an example.
I mean, you're not saying that you're religious vocation was unsatisfying, or the fact that you were working in education wasn't fulfilling. Where are you?
No. I was perfectly content to be a high school English teacher and a teacher of religion in a Catholic high school. But religion required, my view of religion required me to do more than just be a teacher. I was also supposed to practice what I was teaching, practice what I was preaching. And when I met Cesar Chavez and found out that he was actually living a life dedicated to others for the sake of others and was called and felt called to do this work, that was my cup of tea. That is something that challenged me. Interested me. I felt compelled to join. I felt I had met an authentic person. And in the 60s, meeting an authentic person was a rare experience. And I knew that he was authentic. And I could tell he was authentic.
It was just you could sense it.
No, it was more than just sensing his authenticity. He lived it. When I first met him, he didn't own a suit of clothes. He didn't have a bank account. He didn't have a television. He didn't have a washing machine. He didn't own a car. He didn't have any money in his pockets. This man was dedicated to a life of voluntary poverty. And in fact, he lived a life of voluntary poverty for 31 years, dedicating his life to others and trying to help them succeed and try to help them stand up and fight for themselves, make something of themselves, organize themselves. He did that at great personal cost, and I also might add and should add that at great personal cost to his family.
But is that authenticity so rare? I mean, you were struck by this guy. Is he unique, or weren't there other people who were living what they believed?
A person could go through a couple lifetimes. It's been my experience. You could go through a couple lifetimes and never meet a person like Cesar Chavez, a person who was dedicated and who dedicated his life for others. These people come along very rarely. And when they do, and when you meet them, your choice is yes, I'll join, or no, I can't do that. The bar is too high. I can't do that. And basically, when you think about it, that was sort of the choice in the gospel. When Jesus called the rich young man and told him to go sell what he had and come and follow him, and as much as he wanted to do that, as much as he wanted to follow Jesus, he couldn't. He couldn't give away his possessions. He couldn't leave everything for the sake of following Jesus and spreading the good news. So people like Cesar Chavez are maybe one or two in a century, I think. So I have been very blessed. He had a great impact on my life. I owe so much to him. And 40 years ago, as we sit here, he was my best friend. And for a 10-year period, we were inseparable. We spoke constantly, 4 or 5 times a day. We went places together. I drove him places all over California, traveled with him, took care of him as best I could. He was a genuine person. He was a leader. He was charismatic, and yet he was the quietest, most soft-spoken, humble person you'd ever want to meet. A beautiful person.
In 1965, when the strike started, and you had changed careers slightly, you were in graduate school, and he called you and asked you to come and help. Did you, as you say, it was one of those yes or no moments, but did you have any sense of what saying yes would mean for your life?
I had. That's a good question. I was studying for my doctorate at USC in Los Angeles. The strike broke out. He called me, asked me if I would come and work with him on the strike. I said yes, but I knew him I had known him for a couple of years by that time. So I wasn't talking to a stranger. I was talking to a friend. He was talking to a friend, and he needed my help, and I wanted to give it to him. Now, the fact that that would change the entire course of my life, the fact that now, 41 years later, I'm celebrating my 40th wedding anniversary to the woman I married, who I met in the farm worker movement. Now I have 5 daughters. I have 9 grandchildren and 1 on the way. I mean, how could I have possibly even have thought about that or wondered about that? I didn't. I just said yes, and I packed up my things. I went to Delano and reported for duty, if that's the word, and got my assignments, and one thing led to another, and it has for the rest of my life.
Do you remember that conversation when he asked you to help? What his pitch was?
He didn't make a pitch, really. Cesar Chavez was a man of few words, soft-spoken, very much to the point, very polite, very respectful. And he basically said, we're having a tough time, and it's difficult, and if you could come and help, it would be a big help. And so that was the pitch. It was just, right to the point, person to person, no nonsense, no sugarcoating. And I knew it was going to be difficult. Now, at that time, of course, I was a member of a Catholic religious order. I had vows of poverty. I didn't have any money. I lived for 15 years without money and had to ask my religious superiors for everything that I needed. So it wasn't that I was a stranger to living poorly or living without or not being bothered by not having possessions. On the other hand, going to Delano with striking farm workers and living with them, and living with Caesar and his family, who were literally paupers compared to my life as a Christian brother in a Catholic religious order. These people were practically beggars. They were beggars. And I became a beggar. That's how we survived. That's how we went from took one step to the next. Is when I traveled, for example, on behalf of the farm workers, raising money, primarily in Northern California, that's where a lot of support was and a lot of money is, also in Los Angeles area. I spent a lot of time in the Los Angeles area raising funds. I was never given money to go to these places. I had to raise the money myself to get there, gas for the car that I had. I had to find my own places to stay. I had to hustle that. I had to live with other people. I had no money for food. I had to basically rely on others to feed me. That was our way of life in 1965 and 1966. And I guess being a young man, I didn't think much about it. It didn't bother me very much. I did it. And frankly, I did pretty well at it. I raised a lot of money for the Farm Worker Union, and I'm proud of what I accomplished in those first years.
Part of the farm workers is that it was a union, but it wasn't what we think of as a traditional union, was it? Did you get that sense from the beginning that it's going to be different?
Caesar's vision of a farm worker union is the emphasis is on community. The emphasis is on cooperation and cooperatives. When I hung up the phone after my conversation with Caesar and I went to Delano, I just expected that I would be assigned to the picket lines or I'd be assigned to organizing duties of some kind. I didn't know. And much to my amazement, he said to me, "No, I don't want you to work on the picket lines. I don't want you to work on the strike in Delano. I want you to go out and learn how to organize cooperatives. I want you to raise money so that we can build farm worker cooperatives. We need a gas station so that farm workers, a cooperative gas station, so that farm workers can buy their gas or their oil, their tires, their batteries. They have a place, an honest place, where they can get their cars fixed, because the automobile is the absolute essential piece of equipment that farm workers need to earn a living. And so think about that for a minute. I go to Delano thinking I'm going to be marching the picket line, carrying the flags on the marches, and no, he sends me to study cooperatives and raise money and come back and build cooperatives, which I did. If you can believe it, I did.
So this is not standard union bread and butter stuff.
No. Much. Cesar Chavez as a labor leader was an anomaly to labor leaders in this country, because he did not look like a labor leader. He did not act like a labor leader. For example, when he went to conventions to raise funds, labor union conventions, they had their conventions and still do in posh hotels and posh resorts and big dinners and lavish doings. Caesar would go and make his pitch, give his speech, take up a collection for the farm workers, then he would leave. He would not stay in the hotel. He would not stay overnight. Now, labor leaders, they took umbrage. They didn't like that. He was not one of them. And the fact that he lived in voluntary poverty, he did not have a salary, and the way he lived and the way he conducted himself was opposite to what their view of their own position was and how important they were. I'm talking about labor leaders, how important they were and the responsibilities they had and how much they should be paid and et cetera, et cetera. And Caesar just didn't, he wasn't in that frame of reference. And they didn't like it. And they told him so. And he didn't care.
One of the things that set him and the farm workers apart from a lot of things in the country was this central focus on nonviolence. that as an organizing principle was, you know, we'd seen it in the South, but you didn't see it in labor unions. You didn't see it anywhere else. Talk about how important nonviolence was.
The reality is that labor unions in this country, in the United States of America, were built more or less on through violence. I'm not saying totally unjustified. I'm not saying that workers, striking workers, when they see their jobs replaced by others and they see buses and trucks driving through the picket lines. I mean, I know how difficult, because I was there, I know how difficult that is to remain nonviolent. And if you have a family to support and you see your third cousin who's coming in as a strike breaker and being paid extra money to take your job because you're out trying to improve everyone's working conditions and everyone's pay, that is a very difficult situation. And striking back is almost inevitable. I would say it is inevitable. But Cesar Chavez preached and practiced nonviolence. And he believed in it so much that when members of his own union, a few members, began talking about, well, we're not getting very far. I mean, we're not, the growers are still harvesting the grapes. They're still selling the grapes. We've got to take stronger measures. This nonviolence isn't working. We've got to do something to show them who's boss. We got to fight back. And that talk began to gain some currency among the striking farm workers. And so Caesar decided to fast. He fasted without food for 25 days. What he did was he drew a line in the dirt and he said, if you want to stay on this side of the line with me and what I believe in with respect to nonviolence, I want you to do that. If you're going to cross the line, then we're parting company. And I'm going to go out to the 40 acres, that was the union headquarters at that time, and I'm going to fast until you all decide which side of the line you're going to be on. Well, there were a few people. There were, and they were staff members. They were, in some cases, even some of the officers of the union at that time decided that they just couldn't abide by that, that they weren't winning. They felt they weren't making a lot of progress, and violence would be a way to show the growers that the farm workers were strong, they were united, and they were going to win. And you know, there's more farm workers than there are growers, so, you know, a little violence, sure, we might get hurt too, but other people, they're going to get hurt. Well, they left. They were, in effect, forced out. I mean, they were forced out in the sense that Caesar had publicly declared what the commitment to nonviolence was, and they had to make a choice. And it was either with him or not with him. So, now, frankly, it was because of Caesar's commitment to nonviolence that the union, the striking farm workers, had to develop other kinds of tactics, nonviolent tactics, so that they could win union contracts. And it was out of that commitment to nonviolence that the idea of a consumer grape boycott was developed. And it was actually only about 2.5 years of organizing internationally, not just in the United States. It was major cities in the United States, about 40 cities in the United States, but also Canada, and London, Sweden, Scandinavia, a well-organized consumer boycott against California table grapes. And it was the boycott that forced the growers in 1970 to capitulate and to sign union contracts in Delano. It was not the strike. It was not the march to Sacramento. It was not waving of the flags. It was the hard work in the cities of this country and abroad that the growers could not control. Cesar Chavez took the fight to the growers on a turf that they did not control. And Cesar ended up controlling it. And that's how the farm workers won union contracts in 1970.
Let's stay with the past a little bit longer, though. As you said, it was a line, you know, it was a turning point. It was for people to decide how strong their commitment to nonviolence was. For those who stayed, it also didn't have the effect of bringing them together and really forging a more powerful organization.
It was a strange situation. Step back and think about it for a minute. Try to visualize it if you can. Cesar makes his announcement at Filipino Hall in front of a room full of people, a couple of hundred people, farm workers, farm worker supporters, staff members, board members. And he makes this announcement about his fast. He draws a line with respect to nonviolence. He walks out of the hall. He walks 2 miles to the 40 acres. And he sets up shop there by himself. And he doesn't leave the 40 acres for a 25-day period. For 25 days, he's holed up in the 40 acres. One man alone fasting. Now, in the course of those 25 days, Cesar organized more farm workers than in the history of this country. For a very simple reason, that farm workers, when they heard about the fast, they came to Delano, to the 40 acres, from all over California, from Arizona, from Texas. They wanted to meet this person who felt so strongly about their right to have a union, their right to better wages and working conditions, their right to have bathrooms in the fields for themselves and for their wives and for their children. They came to meet this man, and they stood in line, and he talked to them one by one, delegation by delegation. For 25 days he did this. Now, that had the effect of bringing people, workers, from all over the Southwest, especially California, together and knit them together as a group and formed alliances. And Cesar was able to explain to them the meaning of a union, his vision of a union, the benefits of a union, what the strike was about, the need for the boycott, on and on. He was like a teacher. He was like a master teacher. So what an irony. A person goes off by himself, and its effect is to bring people together, thousands of people together, into a cause and committed to that cause. Now, is that accidental, or did he do it on purpose, or did he know what he was doing, or did he have that in mind? I don't know. Sometimes I think he did. Sometimes I say to myself, well, how could he have anticipated that? But this man was a genius with respect to people. He understood human nature. He understood people. He accepted them. He respected them. He was not bombastic. He didn't try to make over people. If he didn't like them or their personalities were such, whatever, he didn't try to change their personalities. He didn't try to well, you have to be this way. You have to act this way. You have to say this. You have to say that. He accepted the person for who or she was and accepted their talents and utilized their talents on behalf of other people. A remarkable person.
Well, not to take away anything from Caesar's genius, but he had a bunch of very smart people working with him, including yourself. And, you know, the fast is one example, the march to Sacramento is another example. I mean, there was a sense in the union, wasn't there, that, well, if this is going to happen, let's make it work, right? And let's do whatever it takes to make it work.
When the strike broke out in Delano, volunteers began to come to Delano, primarily from universities and colleges, but these are young people. I was a little older. I mean, I had been a high school teacher. But when I talk about people coming to Delano, I'm talking about dozens. I'm talking about hundreds. I'm talking about ultimately thousands. People came to Delano. Well, there was no room in Delano. I mean, what are you going to do with all these volunteers, these people? And one of the ways to absorb this energy and this creativity was to marshal them on the boycott, send them out to boycott cities all across the country, and you know, work with them, teach them how to organize a boycott, how to get started. Now, none of us had ever boycotted before, so we were learning by the seat of our pants. We were learning by doing. We made a lot of mistakes, but you learn from your mistakes. You learn by doing, and you go out and throw yourselves at the mercy of people, be they church people or labor people or support groups or liberal groups or conservative groups or whoever you can make contact with. And now, all of this organizing ended up being done by the volunteers who came to Delano. They wanted to be part of this. They wanted to help. They didn't have a preconceived idea, well, I'm going to do this. I should do this. I should do something else. They were willing to accept direction. They were willing to take assignments. They were willing to live in voluntary poverty. They were willing to live under the conditions, very harsh conditions, of going to a city that they had never been to. In some cases, if they were volunteer farm workers, they barely spoke the language. Some didn't even read or write. And yet they had to go to the city. They had to find a place to stay. They had to deliver the message about the striking farm workers. They had to go to the supermarkets and asked consumers not to buy the grapes. So all of this takes time, it takes talent, it takes commitment, it takes learning, it takes making mistakes and picking yourself up and doing better. We all worked 6 days a week minimum, and very frequently we worked 7 days a week. But we always work 6 days a week, from the early morning to the evening. And that's all we did. And we were doing that for the cause of the farm workers, trying to help the farm workers, the poorest workers in our country. They really weren't workers when you think about it. They were like rented slaves. They had no rights, no privileges. They were totally at the beck and call of the owner, of the grower, of the labor contractor. They could be fired instantly. They had no recourse. There were no rules or laws to protect them. They had no worker rights. So maybe they technically were not officially slaves, but unofficially they were powerless and completely dependent upon the landowner for whatever they were able to earn. It was a horrible existence.
Okay, let's change tapes. Let's stop. Let's regroup.
We do need the